Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 17th of March, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. So we'll also be joined today by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. We've got quite a big chunk on matters to do with defence. There's a lot happening. And of course, it's only the UK column that has been warning about EU military unification. We've also got David Scott from Northern Exposure, and David's going to be taking us through some of the things happening around the Scottish referendum.
But we're going to start with Melanie Shaw. Now, somebody who's supporting Melanie is asking for people to take part in a tweet storm tonight, on Thursday, the 23rd of March, between 8 and 10 p.m. So we're going to be advertising this over the next few days. Basically, Free Melanie Shaw is the hashtag. I'm sure there are lots of people would appreciate receiving tweets on this subject next Thursday. I don't know, Theresa May, for example.
Amber Rudd. Well. And Mike, this is terribly important. I was able to listen to a recording of Melanie speak a couple of days ago. What she's enduring in prison, HM prison, Foston Hall, is truly horrific. And we now know from other prisoners that the wardens are simply telling prisoners that Melanie is mentally ill and not to believe a word she says. What I heard in Melanie's own voice was extremely composed. And of course, the truth of the matter is the British government wants this lady silenced because of her knowledge of the abuse and deaths of children and connections back through to the British government in Westminster.
So just to correct what I said earlier, that is Thursday the 23rd, between 8 and 10 p.m.
I'm UK glad you're time. Having some problems on dates, Mike. Helps with my age issue. Well, where do we go from Melanie? Well, let's go to Patriot Missile Systems, because shock, horror, apparently somebody has used a mere $3 million missile to shoot down a $200 drone. This has caused a bit of panic in the American military system because, of course, I think that's known as overkill, Mike.
Yes.
And presumably the nation that can put up most of the $200 drones is going to win in an economic sense pretty quickly.
That would be ISIS.
That'll be ISIS. Well, let's bring in an American general, because these are some of the highly educated people. What does this gentleman have to say? Well, he says this: we have a very close ally of ours that was dealing with an adversary using a small quadcopter, and they shot it down with a Patriot missile. The problem, he said, wasn't effectiveness. The tiny drone didn't stand a chance. The issue is economic. The situation showed whoever was flying the drone now knows that they can easily undermine this unnamed ally with the missiles. All they need to do is buy more cheap drones and fly them, running up the operational costs of the military. It's taken a general from the commander of the US Army Training and Doctrine Command to work this out, Mike. This is astonishing.
Is this real, Brian?
It is real. Okay. This is not even newspeak. This is the world's most powerful military has suddenly worked out that if it gives its missile systems to people who are not really capable of operating them, they're going to do stupid things, perhaps shoot down a Russian aircraft. That's one end of the scale. But a $3 million missile to shoot down a drone. Well, he goes on because he says this, basically the United States Army is a concept-based, doctrine-driven army. We have doctrine that drives what we do today.
What's that doctrine?
I thought you might ask, so I'll put it on screen, because embedded in this gentleman's talk is a video, which is quite astonishing. Multi-domain battle, the continuing evolution of warfare. And it said something very significant in the middle of this video clip. It said this: war is the ultimate agent of change.
I think that says it all.
That says it all, and leads us nicely, of course, into lies around the unification of EU defence.
Well, indeed, and of course, that unification is being mainly driven by the Council of Europe, and so this is the European Parliament now has put out a nice little infographic, defence doing more with less, the benefits of closer cooperation at an EU level, and as we can see there, they're pushing through some really nice information about the size of EU and US, comparing the EU and the US in terms of GDP, in terms of investment on defence, and in terms of actual materiel and so on. But as I say, this is the European Parliament that's pushing this out. And, well, why are they doing this? Well, because they have pushed through a resolution a couple of weeks ago, which they say finally underlines the need for further reflection on the future relations between, with regard to EU unification. They say that defence cooperation in the EU is now more dependent on political will than on legal considerations. They say that the Foreign Affairs and Constitutional Affairs Committees held a joint sort of meeting. They passed a joint resolution. Here it is on screen. They suggested treating European Defence Agency as a sort of independent EU institution funded by the EU budget. They advocate establishing a defence ministers meeting format within the EU Council of Ministers. And this resolution, which was approved by 48 votes to 21 with one abstention, they say underlines that developing an EU common defence policy depends above all on the political will of member states, as the Lisbon Treaty already provides a sufficient framework for building a truly common defence policy. And they're saying that they want the European Defence Agency, as I say, and the permanent structured cooperation to be treated as what they're describing as sui generis EU institutions, so standalone sort of thing. Now, there was something interesting in the press release that went with this, and that was they were talking about EU-UK relations, and they say the resolution finally underlines the need for further reflection on the future relations between the EU and the UK, particularly in the field of military capabilities, should the country decide to leave the European Union. And perhaps this gives us an indication about how on the ball these guys are, because, as we say, that unification is being driven through the Council of Europe and through the European Commission. And of course, we know what the relationship is, Brian, between these institutions and the European Parliament. The European Parliament merely rubber stamps decisions that have already been made. So they're now saying, basically, well, they don't see any reason not to rubber stamp the decisions that have already been made, because within the Lisbon Treaty, there's already the provision for this. Yep. So that's where we are with it. David Ellis, this resolution was pushed through with absolutely no comment in the British mainstream press.
Yeah, it's true to form, isn't it? There's absolutely no debate, no challenging, no scrutiny on this issue whatsoever. So, you know, the dictatorial commission and council, you know, push it through the facade of their parliament. So what we're seeing here really is that, I mean, those comments that they're making are more with more, actually, not more with less. They want more, and it's more all round. What I'm hearing is that the political alignment, which is a verbal process, it will simply be Herr Juncker's asking Theresa May to agree to this, which will trigger the process which the EU own. So it's vital, really. We're at the watershed moment. This is it. And they're coming over the top, and they're coming over the top right now. And what do we have our end? You know, basically the portcullis is up, and there is nothing happening in Parliament on this at all.
Brian, the other thing that stuck out in that last little remark there was, should the UK decide to leave the European Union? I thought that decision had already been made, but clearly MEPs don't quite understand that.
Well, I think they do understand it, Mike, because we haven't left the European Union. There's no intention of us leaving the European Union. There's a frontal image that we're leaving. There's lots of talk about leaving. There's all the Brexit talk. Article 50 talk, but behind the scenes, what is continuing at an accelerating pace is locking us into the EU, and particularly in a military sense. We can come back into this subject, and we'll come back to you, David Ellis, in just a second to comment on this. One of our viewers kindly picked up a National Audit Office report for Parliament. This was part of it. It said the NAO found there is an increasing pressure on a few highly trained personnel to operate the capability. This is the new carriers. There's a shortage of military personnel running at 4% below target strength. Staffing gaps included engineering roles and war fighting specialists in the Royal Navy and engineering intelligence and some aircrew cadres in the RAF. To minimise the impact on these gaps on carrier strike, the department is prioritising it and carrying out. So we have not got enough people and the right experts to run these two new carriers that are apparently coming into service. We haven't yet got the aircraft for them. We haven't got the radar systems. But the fact that you have not got the engineers and the flight deck specialists, this is either incompetence on a scale that's never been seen in the military, in British military procurement, or we're watching an organised chaos to make sure that the UK military is deliberately weak to assist this EU unification. And David, before I come over to you, I'll just bring this one in as well. A viewer kindly sent us some email correspondence between them themselves, Linda and Lord Tebbit. And this is particularly interesting. So Lord Tebbit says, "Dear Linda, thank you for your email dated the 14th of March. I have no doubt that as part of its plan to become a single state, the EU is planning to have its own single defence force alongside its own single currency. However, although our armed forces are not sufficiently strong, I know of no plans or conspiracy to disband NATO as part of that ambition." And the lady goes back and says, "I'm somewhat confused by your words. When EU military union happens, there will be no money for NATO and it will quietly fizzle out as intended." And then if you freeze this screen, you can obviously see the precise comments. But the lady ends it by saying, "Does this ring any bells? We must not forget that Germany has always considered any orientation towards the West as a policy of expedience. It must be our supreme duty to place ourselves in the vanguard of the struggle to keep Europe out of any future war. If we succeed in this, we'll surely gain the trust of the people and undisputed leadership in Europe, not excluding Britain. In such a roundabout way, we'll be able to establish the foundation for future world leadership." And I haven't seen a further reply for Lord Tebbit on this. But David, I know that you've been in communication with this gentleman. Are there any MPs who understand the speed at which this EU integration is taking place?
There's probably on a couple of levels here what the issues are. It's not necessarily understanding, but what there is a complete void. And I said this before: the crisis is in the gatekeepers and the controllers of the Tory Party, that they're refusing to debate and engage on this issue at all because they know damn well they can't sell it at the ballot box. It would be an election killer, and that's why they're not debating it, and that's why it's being conducted in the way that it's going on, and it's been pretty much been ingressing in since the 1957 Sandys paper. But we're now getting to the main gate decision. This is where we are with this unification thing. So the carriers that we think we have them, they're Royal Navy carriers. Well, they're not going to be Royal Navy carriers for very long under this arrangement because they'll be in EU NAVFOR. They'll be in the EU Navy and they'll be operated under the EU Navy. So this is where everybody's got a sort of heads up, look at the horizon and just pay attention to this strategic forecasting that we're doing here. And this issue that we keep coming back to with they know of no plans or plot or conspiracies. Well, no, there isn't, because it's absolutely in plain view.
Right.
They're doing it and it's happening now. So there is no conspiracy. It's actually being conducted.
David, let me just bring you this on screen, which we'll do very quickly, because you've hit the nail on the head. Here's Clegg. This was during a debate that he had with Nigel Farage last year. He said the idea there's going to be a European Air Force army is simply not true. This is a dangerous fantasy. Now, I've labelled this lies because it's absolute lies. What this man doesn't mention, of course, is Navy. You've just mentioned Navy. Why does Clegg not mention Navy? Well, here's another source on the internet who's worked it out. The EU not only has its own Navy with warships, that should be, it now wants a nuclear arsenal. And this report says very clearly that the European Union's Political and Security Committee exercises political control and strategic direction of this first EU maritime military operation under the authority of the Council of the European Union and the High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Her Excellency Federica Mogherini. So basically, Clegg couldn't mention the word Navy because the European Navy was already in force.
Absolutely correct. Yeah. And it had been alive and kicking in our own HQ at Northwood for quite some time, you know, under the construction of senior Royal Navy officers at the time. You know, granted, they're just carrying out orders. And obviously this alludes to, you know, to real substantial embedded policy that's come through.
Yeah.
So it's an utter nonsense what we're seeing here. It's a sort of masquerade. It's almost as if we're into some sort of realm of like the Emperor's New Clothes, and nobody dare to stand up and go, we're naked.
Well, you know? Absolutely right. Let's just bring that slide back on. I've added a bit to at the bottom because they say in this article correctly, the EU's not a country. It doesn't have national territory. It's a private organisation that attracts nations as members and seeks to usurp member nations' power for their own. They are a corporation that have their own navy and are now looking to get nuclear weapons. How would you feel if Starbucks or Walmart were permitted to own a nuclear arsenal? This is a pretty astute statement by this by the author of this article.
Yeah, it's a terrific piece. Apart from he's not got the anecdotal and the, you know, the focus of the thing here. This isn't like giving nuclear weapons to Starbucks or Walmart. This is giving nuclear weapons to a bank.
European Central Bank, you have in mind.
Yes. Yeah. We're going to arm a bank with nuclear weapons. that's where we are. This is no laughing matter. This is exactly the course of this action.
Yeah, and we have Theresa May and Michael Fallon who simply deny that this is happening. It's incredible. Well, let's go back to the House of Lords again here with this one. This is a report that was kindly provided to us, NATO Alliance Recent Developments. We just highlight a bit here. It says, in addition to the new deployment of military forces, NATO agreed at its 2016 summit in Warsaw measures to increase ability to defend members from cyber attack. The enhancing NATO resilience to attack through increased civil preparedness and a joint declaration with the European Union to expand cooperation. So everything is about expanding through to the with this unified EU military system. It's obvious. And in this same report, I thought you would enjoy this, David, because who do we find? Well, we find two names from the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI. We've mentioned Dr. Jonathan Isle before, but we've now also got Ewan Lawson. We'll bring Ewan up first of all. I encourage people to go to the RUSI website and have a look at it. I could not believe my eyes when I read this through, because it says he's an ex-RAF policing specialist. Was this man a military policeman? He's now done a degree or two, and apparently he's now able to advise the UK government on defence policy. I mean, who are these people? Let's bring the other one on. Not only is Jonathan Isle RUSI, he's basically a lecturer. I've been a bit naughty. I've called him a teacher here. But we've got a Romanian teacher. Have we done any background checks on this man? I had my background checked before I was able to join the Royal Navy and certainly handle classified material. Who are these people? But he goes on. And we've got a talk that's been given recently with RUSI working alongside UK in a changing Europe. I've put some of the people involved, speakers. I encourage our audience to go and have a look at those. But let's just see how this works. So we've got RUSI teamed up with the UK in a changing Europe. Who are they funded by? Well, basically, it's the Economic and Social Research Council. So there's the money going in. Who's the Economic and Social Research Council? Non-departmental public body established by Royal Charter, 1965. So that's all pretty clear. They've got a mere £192 million to give into these so-called independent groups. And if we have a look at who's in this organisation, well, we've got Alan Gillespie, former partner Goldman Sachs. I think you get the idea pretty quickly. We've got social services. We've got a gentleman who works with the BBC. We've got a man connected with the Bank of England and is very big on data and statistics. And then we come back to this lady here who's a Viva France. So I'm not quite sure how this works with UK defence. And I've put here, well, we do fund ourselves. And that's because I discovered that ESRC hands out grant money, but they do actually fund themselves if they're involved in projects.
So ESRC, large banking and financial interests.
Yep.
And they decide where the money goes.
They decide where the money goes. So I spoke to the UK in a changing Europe this morning, just had a little chat with them, and they said yes, they do get the bulk of their money from ESRC. I've asked them how much. They said they will tell me. They say they're independent, but they're embedded in King's University, so I fail to see how this works out. And as you've pointed out, Mike, big banking interests at the back of it. So David, you've said there that of course the real danger with the European Union is who is driving the thing. Well, of course, it's banking interests. And we've got those same banking interests helping to fund RUSI debate on why we should team up with the European Union, even though we're supposedly leaving. It's Alice in Wonderland, but it's very dangerous.
It's completely dangerous. It's completely demeaning to the British electorate to carry on in this fashion. As if our military isn't of any importance or any regard, or the industry and all the people that work within that are of no importance, because they are. And this is being conducted in such a fashion. It is absolutely reprehensible that the parliamentarians cannot get together and get on top of this, because it is just breathtaking that there isn't the regard to view actually what's going on. As I've said, the portcullis is up. But with regard to RUSI, you know, they're not RUSI at all. It's UCI. It's the European Institute. It's virtually an extension of the Erasmus program here to bring in, you know, all people from all over Europe to drive the European military unification agenda. And that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, it's a stitch up because they're the go-to institution for comments on this fashion. And of course, we're just getting completely and utterly the European narrative and the European rhetoric. You know, it's no good at all. And I'm reassured by that, by a couple of former First Sea Lords and some generals that I spoke to on this subject, and a great deal of middle ranking officers that have absolutely no regard for RUSI at all, because of obviously what's going on there. You know, this is just it's a joke. You know, our government needs to get a grip with it. But of course, it means getting a grip with all the bigger picture. But I've got to say, where NATO is concerned, and this is one stumbling block that we keep coming up against, whether we're in NATO or in anything, our forces bear the responsibility for the security of this nation. So to hang your hat on NATO and say, you know, we can kind of say that that's their, you know, partly their responsibility, it's not. It's our Her Majesty's Armed Forces, Royal Navy, Royal Air Force, everybody that's in there, and what industry we've got left that underwrite the security of this nation. And to keep putting NATO into the hat is like a crutch. It's ridiculous, because if these people don't realise that NATO is currently undergoing the same unification process that we are as a nation, because the EU are ingressing into NATO at a far greater rate their end than what they are into the British military. So there's a lot of effort going into that. There will only be one pot of money, and that one pot of money controlled by the financiers and the bankers will be European Military Union. That's it. It will be single point. The whole object of this is unification to one single point control. They have to in order to set the budget, and they have to in order to precipitate with the currency. So it's vitally important.
I mean, we just have to, any time Federica Mogherini and Jens Stoltenberg meet, they're immediately snogging each other. It's pretty clear what the relationship is there. They're very, very friendly, very close. But just before we move on from this, I'm just going to mention that if you look on the front page of the UK column website, in the right-hand column is a little box for EU military unification. Do go and have a look at that. We've just put up a timeline showing how this has progressed. There's some more items to add to that timeline, but please look at that to get an impression of the direction of travel, and it'll make it pretty clear for everybody where this is going to end up.
And we can also add that at the moment it's only UK column, of course, with the assistance of David Ellis and Alex Thompson, that's bringing this matter to a head. We're now starting to see some of the so-called mainstream media following.
Okay, G20. The G20 is finance ministers meeting is taking place. Actually, to be correct about this, it's the finance ministers and central bank governors who are meeting in Baden-Baden today at the G20. They're there apparently to discuss free trade. They're particularly concerned that Donald Trump has torn up the TPP, and they're worried about what he might do next. They're holding a symposium this morning called Global Economic Confidence in a Multipolar World. Is that multipolar or bipolar? I'm not quite sure. But free trade is not their only concern, it seems. Mark Carnegie is not there in person, but he has written them a little note. And in that note to the finance chiefs, he has said that the Financial Stability Board is taking steps to make financial benchmarks more trustworthy after all the various bank fraud that's gone on. And he wants to achieve the G20's objective of strong, sustainable and balanced growth. But he says that requires open markets, durable international capital flows, resilient financial institutions, robustness of market-based finance, and an end to too big to fail. And it's this end too big to fail, which I took particular note of. He discusses in his letter transforming shadow banking into resilient market-based finance, making derivatives markets safer, effective and dynamic implementation of post-crisis reforms. I mean, how many years are we post the crisis and they're still discussing whether or not they can implement post-crisis reforms? In his letter, he said a decade on from the start of the crisis, the G20 has made substantial progress in building a financial system that is more resilient and better able to fund households and businesses in a sustainable way. As the global recovery gains strength, now is not the time to risk these hard-won gains. So, and he says that the work recognises that while fines and sanctions deter misconduct, preventative measures, including those which increase individual accountability, can also play important roles. And what he seems to be doing here is perhaps suggesting that maybe we might be prosecuting people that commit fraud rather than sort of just brushing it under the carpet or issuing the odd little fine. But I think what he's particularly concerned about is the continuing pressure for Glass-Steagall. Donald Trump has said that he is very keen to see the return of Glass-Steagall. And actually today in the Italian Chamber of Deputies, they are discussing 12 draft bills on bank separation. Carney particularly concerned about that. David, you got any thoughts on this?
Which David?
David Scott, I should say.
Many. End too big to fail. That's very interesting. We had a problem with institutions being too big to fail, and the response has been to make them bigger, yes? We've taken over smaller institutions. The recent one we reported on was the tiniest Airdrie Savings Bank, but lots of other banks have gone and have been rolled into fewer institutions. And, we've recapitalized them from taxpayers' money, but they're bigger than they were before. So are we talking about actually splitting these up? Are we actually going to do anything? I seriously doubt it.
Well, of course, he doesn't want to see them split up, but that seems to be the political pressure seems to be building for that in at least two countries. So that's what they're concerned about, I suspect.
Yeah, making derivatives safer, that would be like making fire less hot, I think. Yes. They'd love to see what he's going to say on that. And I particularly enjoyed the as the recovery gains strength. How long have we been hearing this?
Yes.
The next major recession is just about. It's overdue. It's just around the corner. So you always know to be worried when central bankers start talking about as the economy gains strength. That's when you need to be finding one of two positions, either the liquid position or the fetal position. No talk about ZIRP and the fact that with zero interest rates, the very basis for international finance, pensions and all the rest of it has been held below the waterline. Is that, that doesn't feature, does it, Mike?
It doesn't seem to. He certainly didn't mention it in his letter.
Well, there's a surprise. Yes, ZIRP and NIRP are entirely new, are aberrations and completely out with the realms of rationality. And a generation ago, we believed it was all impossible. But now we have to believe many impossible things before breakfast in order to attend international finance meetings.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, on Wednesday with Alex, we mentioned Judge Andrew Napolitano and the whole GCHQ thing. He had said on Fox News, three intelligence sources have informed Fox News that President Obama went outside the chain of command. He didn't use the NSA. He didn't use the CIA. He didn't use the FBI. He didn't use the Department of Justice. He used GCHQ. And we highlighted the comments from Reuters that from some unnamed source denying that this had been the case. And we also pointed out that there was no UK mainstream news coverage of this whatsoever on Wednesday on a couple of different searches that we did on Google. Well, repeating those searches today sees a somewhat different picture because, of course, GCHQ has now, in an unprecedented move, issued a statement on this. So much more mainstream coverage of it after Alex Thompson has made his comments. Well, this is what they had to say. Recent allegations made by media commentator Judge Andrew Napolitano about GCHQ being asked to conduct wiretapping against the then president-elect are nonsense. They're utterly ridiculous and should be ignored. Well, this morning, the BBC Radio 4 Today programme had this gent, Brian Lord, OBE, on. And he was basically saying, this isn't a direct quote, it's a bit of a paraphrase, but it's accurate. Such activity would have had to be cleared right up to the Secretary of State level, is what he said. But he immediately turned the conversation round to fake news. And he said, but the bigger issue, more or less, he said that what the bigger issue is that this is an example of fake news, which is being used for political and geopolitical purposes. The Nick Robinson, the BBC commentator, had a long discussion about fake news and how the BBC and other mainstream media might be able to persuade people of what's true and what's not. I asked Alex about Brian Lord and what his history in GCHQ is. And Alex said, well, he was a long-standing GCHQ man. He was aware of him. He wasn't like the last GCHQ person that we mentioned on the programme that Alex basically hadn't heard of, was a bit of a shoe-in. This guy has served in a wide range of roles for GCHQ at home and abroad, is what Alex is saying. Alex was pretty outraged, actually, by what this guy was doing, because he wasn't holding Nick Robinson's comments, his utterly biased comments on the BBC, to account.
Yeah, what makes me laugh in this one, Mike, is the fact that, oh my goodness, there's checks and balances in place and we're scrutinised at government level to make sure we don't do this. On the other screen to my right here, I've got the Telegraph article, which is calmly saying that the NSA, the Americans, paid GCHQ £100 million to actually spy for them. And somebody else in the chat box has said, well, actually, it's also reported that GCHQ was misappropriating its facilities for people to spy on their spouses.
We should also remember that in the Vault 7 release from WikiLeaks last week or the week before, GCHQ and the CIA were working together to hack people's Samsung televisions. That was a joint operation. And let's also remember that, of course, Privacy International had taken GCHQ to court on several occasions over this. And the final judgment on this, which came out in July 2016, said the data gathering regimes, there were two of them, the data gathering regimes under which such data were obtained and retained until those dates, March and November 2015, for each of the two regimes, They were non-compliant with Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights and therefore unlawful. So GCHQ was breaking the law. There's no question about that. And if what their representative has said this morning is true, that any activity of GCHQ such as this would have to be
approved at the government level.
Approved at government level. Well, that says quite a bit about the government.
Perhaps it was.
Indeed. David Scott, just briefly.
I remember from years ago discussions of how this worked, that we spy for the Americans because of their rules governing operation of organizations like the CIA being prohibited within America on American citizens. So it was a reciprocal arrangement where the British did it. I see the British official told Reuters, under British law, GCHQ can only gather information for international security purposes, and noted that the US general election, quote, clearly doesn't meet that criteria. But of course, the excuse for tapping Donald Trump's phone was that they were investigating some link with Russia and Russian banking and Russian influence, which would, of course, meet that criteria. Yes, I don't buy any of this, and I think it's very interesting that we're seeing Judge Napolitano and indeed the President of the United States asking very searching questions of our security services.
Well, I'd just point out that the President of the United States has now said that he will not be asking the questions again. So the matter seems to be dropped at this point from a diplomatic point of view, at least. Right, let's stick with snooping, David. And ID database proposals dropped in Scotland.
This has been bubbling under for many years. And in fact, we were almost talking about it just 2 weeks ago, but there was so much happening on the news it didn't make the cut. The basis of the ID system was going to be an enormous database centred on the NHS and centred on medical records, but building out and sharing information across Europe, across the government, all branches of the government. But it's been dropped all of a sudden. Don't know why. Maybe they've got other things on their minds. Maybe they don't need another named person like European Court of Human Rights or UK Supreme Court defeat. Maybe they've got other plans. But hooray, they have dropped this idea. Another small victory for kernel of right-thinking and well-doing that represents liberty in this country.
Right, well, we have a quick advertisement for a named person-related event, so let's have a look at that and then you can comment on it, David.
John Swinney has restated his commitment to a state guardian for every child in Scotland. Thankfully, No To Named Person is holding a special event on Monday the 20th of March in Edinburgh at the John McIntyre Conference Centre. The reality is that GIRFIC is already embedded in all practice around children and families. Far from supporting families, we believe that this legislation continues to be a real and present danger to all. We must oppose it, however long it takes to end this extraordinary assault on the family.
Anyone who can make it along to get to that event, it's being there's a very top panel speaking there. Jim Sillars is one of the panelists. And there are going to be people looking. There's also going to be the lawyer who led the effort in the UK Supreme Court fighting the legislation, Aidan O'Neill. He'll also be there. So there'll be a section of the event looking at the legal aspects of this, and then a section looking at the wider cultural aspects and the resistance that's building within the Scottish population. And there'll be a large Q&A session at the end of it. So open to all. So hopefully a lot of people will make it along and find out a lot about what's going on.
And sorry, just remind us what the date of that is.
That's on Monday. On Monday the 20th of March.
Okay. David, we're sort of running out of time, but let's just quickly run through this. The Courier in Scotland reporting emergency cover to be brought in from other schools to meet teacher shortages Well, the Courier also reporting that in First Minister's questions on Thursday, I think that takes place, doesn't it? That Nicola Sturgeon was slated for pursuing the independence vote amid the teacher shortage. So, does this go beyond a single school?
Yes, there is a teaching crisis in Scotland, and it's something that I'd like to talk, perhaps in another format, at some length, because it's a very interesting question. But this illustrates neatly the nature of the problem. We pay more and more, we get less and less through the governmental system as the friction, as the inefficiency just mounts up year on year. So this was a school in the constituency of the Education Secretary, John Swinney, and it put out an appeal for parents who have mathematics or related to degrees to come along and run evening classes at the school to help the children prepare for exams, because the teacher shortage was so severe that there were the pupils were being disadvantaged in the exam preparation. So you're seeing here a system very much at breaking point. We have huge numbers of vacancies. Some of it's named person related. There are wider issues that relate to the nature of education and whether the state and government really has any correct role in this at all. It's an interesting issue I'd like to talk to you at length about later on, but that's just a little data point where teachers are so thin in the ground that parents are being asked to go in and fill in the gaps.
Okay, now last Sunday you published an opinion piece on the UK Column website called Getting to Yes, and this was to do with a meeting that you attended in Perth. Tell us what that was about.
Right, this was Yes Perth City, which is a campaigning group which was preparing for the then unannounced second independence referendum. And they were, they'd been in existence for several months. This was their second meeting, and they were talking about how to build capacity and build funding and get ready. This was a phony war, but the real war was coming, and get ready for the forthcoming independence referendum. It was a very interesting event. I must admit I had a whale of a time. It was very, very, very friendly people, and I was asking lots of difficult questions, and it was quite enlightening. Now, the opening of the event was quite striking. There was a large cardboard tube provided, and out of this was produced a roll of glossy paper, which was unrolled with great reverence. And it was explained that this was purchased just the other day in Germany. And it's a map. It's a map of Europe. And it says European Union 2019 post-Brexit. And the coloured in bits, which include Scotland, are EU, and the white bits are non-EU. So the United Kingdom of England, Wales and Northern Ireland is shown there as a non-EU country by 2019, and Scotland is shown as quote-unquote independent, but part of the EU, a vassal state of Germany. And so the country is split in two. Now, this was viewed with great glee by the chap running this event, and I thought it was tremendously concerning that there is no debate, there's no desire for this in Scotland. Here you have a politically motivated fraction of the Scottish population looking to break up the country, looking to link us to a German-dominated EU, which is in catastrophic meltdown, with riots in the streets and soon to be a huge financial crisis because, let's face it, Britain pays a lot of the bills. And there is no thought to anything other than destroy, destroy, destroy. They're trying to destroy the nation. They're trying to destroy the family. They're trying to destroy many things. And it's a very destructive, toxic set of ideas. The meeting went on, and I started asking questions, and a couple of things just to sort of set the scene. There was a call from the floor by someone organising the SNP local election campaign in the area not to big up, not to call, not to advertise the second independence referendum until after the elections in May, because they were trying to keep it quiet. They were trying to get an election campaign fought on local issues and not have it taken over by the independence referendum, which will obviously mobilise the pro-conservative Tory opposition to an independent Scotland. And that's obviously been ignored by Nicola Sturgeon, and that's tactically interesting. And the other thing was right at the end, I was asking questions about, well, what are the Scottish people going to be asked to vote about? Because there is no There is no draft constitution. We've been asked to vote for something we've never seen. We don't know what sort of country that the second independence referendum is actually offering. And the answer was, well, we're dealing with potentialities and options here. It will all be worked out in the future. You vote first, then there'll be a constitutional convention. And then we'll establish the government. And then that government will last 1,000 years. So they actually did say it's going to be 1,000-year Reich. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for that.
Well, all of those events north of the border, David, show this calculated political manoeuvring. Somebody is keen, clearly, to break up the United Kingdom. And of course, who gains most out of the UK breaking up? It's got to be Europe. And as you've said, Germany is the powerhouse. We've also got trouble in UK at the moment with people who say they're in control of common law. Once again, thank you to a viewer that pointed this out for us. It's a talk that Lord Chief Justice of England Wales gave to the City of London Solicitors Company in Mansion House on the 13th of March. And if we just expand a bit of it so we can see, he says, as this company will know, a great deal of time and effort has been devoted since the 23rd of June, considering the implications of Brexit for legal services, the legal professions and the legal community. I'm delighted that in recent weeks, the judiciary, the City UK and other bodies have been able to join with legal professions in forming the Brexit Legal Committee. So we've got the judiciary in bed with the City UK. Please go and have a look at that site, because this represents all things to do with vast global profit-making corporations based in the City of London. They've been having nice little meetings with the judiciary as to how law needs to run with Brexit. And in case you can't see it on screen, let's underline this bit here. Developing a strategy for maintaining and enhancing the utilisation of English common law after Brexit. Now, I found this very, very interesting that what we're seeing here is apparently the judges are ready to enhance common law in order to make sure that men in the City of London can make maximum profit after Brexit. Here's the City UK. Nice little image there, Mike. I was intrigued by the Angel of the North firmly in the middle of London. I believe that's significant, but we'll save that for another day. They also say they're independent, presumably in some way. Not too sure what that is. What's the mission? Well, here we are. It's UK-based financial and related professional services industry to ensure that we stay globally competitive. So judiciary, nice little talks with the big money-making boys to decide how they're going to change common law. And I'll just bring this one in, which I found while I was researching the subject. This is the BBC back in 2016 with an article by Mr. Rosenberg saying, is English common law at risk of becoming out of date? And what did this educated legal man say? Common law is made by judges rather than Parliament. I thought that was a pretty powerful, inaccurate statement. And one of the things that, of course, British Constitution Group is going to work extremely hard to pick up on in the April 22nd conference.
David Scott, first, any closing remarks on that?
I would just like to let everyone know that we have organised a replacement venue for the Gilad Atzmon talk in Glasgow. So that's Thursday, the 30th of March. We are going to be at the Cabana Hall in Seaward Street in Glasgow, 7 till 9:30, and there are tickets available on Eventbrite, and we'll follow up with further notification via Twitter and on the website.
Okay, thank you. And David Ellis?
I'll be at the Nottingham Moot, and we will be holding a anti-European Union military unification workshop there. So anybody wishing to attend that, please come along.
Okay, super.
Excellent. Well, what else have we got to say? Just that if you haven't got your tickets for that British Constitution Group event, I encourage you to buy online, because we don't know how many tickets we're going to be able to sell at the door on the day. Potentially very large numbers of people for this event. So if you want to be sure of getting a ticket, getting involved, buy through the website. And we'll say that yesterday we did push out the first information about the programme. What this event is about is workshops. This is not set peace talks. This is about getting you all together in workshops to share your knowledge in a number of different subject areas. So there's everything from defence to common law, Article 61. We're going to be talking about the NHS. We're going to be talking about child abuse. And this is for the information of the groups that we know are across the country to come together and share with other people. Potentially, this is really a momentous event. And we'll also say thank you very much to those of you who've donated. We've had a flurry of donations over the last few days, and these are very much appreciated. And we've also had a take up of our lifetime membership, which we've put up on the site recently. So thank you very much to those people that have decided to take that option. That's it for us today. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.